You're listening to Earth Chats.
Hey everybody, welcome to Earth Chats, where we bring you the scoop on environmental topics that you can do something about today. This podcast is brought to you from Scarce, an environmental nonprofit located in Illinois just outside of Chicago. We've been in the business of environmental advocacy, education, and action for about 30 years now, and we've been itching to talk to you about all the things we care about. All right, let's get chatting.
Welcome, everybody, to episode number 6 of Earth Chats.
Wow, 6.
6.
Wow, we're moving ahead.
Today we're going to be chatting about permaculture and what it means pertaining to gardening. We've had 2 episodes ourselves already on gardening, so we'll go over some of the things we discussed. But first, let me tell you who's here with us today. In the Scarce Recording Studio here today is Kay McKean, founder and director of Scarce, and our guest, Mike Knapp, longtime friend and collaborator.
Longtime
with
friend.
Scarce. And recently, very recently, retired middle school science teacher.
Yeah.
Hey, Dr. Michael Knapp.
Yes, Dr. Yeah.
Dr.
Do we have to call you Dr.?
Just Mike.
Just Mike.
Oh, just Mike.
And I'm Carol Richard, another retired teacher and volunteer here at Scarce. So we've had these episodes, 3 and 4, mm-hmm. where we talked about gardening. And Mike, here are the things we covered, because you weren't with us. We talked about the importance of gardening in the environment and to our own personal health, our neighborhoods, our surroundings.
Our pollinators.
And that's the next thing. We talked about various kinds of gardens mm-hmm. By function.
Right.
So rain gardens that we would install where there are wet spots in our yards, pollinator gardens to increase the numbers of pollinators, which we so sorely need here in our environment. We talked about sensory gardens, and you, Kay, were saying, well, that's a really good one for children.
Oh my goodness, yes. It's real important.
Yeah. And then prairie gardens.
Mm-hmm. Native plant gardens.
Caitlin was with us, and she has been container gardening her mm-hmm. whole life mm-hmm. and living in a condo. Mm-hmm. And so she told us some things about container gardening mm-hmm. and a certain kind of container gardening called earth box mm-hmm. gardening, which sounded really interesting. Mm-hmm. So we've talked about various kinds of gardening and some tools. You reminded us about the lead in hoses and that we should get lead-free hoses for our gardens. So, but we didn't talk a lot about, you know, how you garden. Well, yes, you told us, Kay, about, you know, getting to know our yards.
Mm-hmm. The sunny spots, mm-hmm. the shadier spots.
Yeah.
Yep.
And know what plants mm-hmm. go there. And emphasizing native plants.
Yes.
All right.
So important.
So these are the things we've been talking about, Mike. Now, what I'm wondering is about permaculture, because I've heard about it a little bit. I got friends in California.
Friends in high places, huh?
Uh-huh. And Kay says that you've been in gardening according to this system. What is it that inspired you to shift from regular gardening or traditional?
Well, I grew up on a farm in Garden Prairie.
Oh.
It was a gentleman's farm. We were surrounded by big farms, but we would do a lot of our own, you know, like half-acre garden. And it was traditional gardening.
Uh-huh.
You had rows, and you spent a lot of time weeding and doing all that kind of stuff. By nature, I'm lazy. So permaculture appeals, because in permaculture, Bill Mollison came up with the idea back in the 70s. And he was teaching ag in Australia, and Australia has issues being basically a desert, you know, as a continent. And he was realizing the way we farm is what's causing the problem. So monoculture farming, and we even tend to do it in our gardens. I've got my row of cukes, I've got my row of tomatoes, I've got my row of this. That's not how nature does anything.
That's right.
You know? And so he was looking at what do indigenous peoples do? How do they do that? So, for instance, like when the Europeans first showed up to North America, they're like, oh, these natives, they're lazy. You know, they only work a few hours a day. What, you know, what's their problem? Why aren't they industrious like us? Well, we're kind of the idiots. We're working 8, 10, 12-hour days because of the system we're designing. So Bill was trying to come up with a way to come up with a permanent culture, and thus the word permaculture.
Permanent. That's where the perma comes
yeah.
from.
And so in permaculture, what you're thinking of, there are three main values, so to speak. Earth care, people care, fair share. So when you're thinking of a permaculture system, you're thinking of, am I designing something that is actually going to help the earth versus just take from the earth? And is it good for people? And am I using a fair allotment of the resources available? And then there are 12 basic principles that are involved in permaculture. So first is observing. So most of us in our suburbs, we buy our house, we don't pay any attention to which way the house faces, how the sun is hitting it, anything. And so in permaculture, you pay attention. What is nature giving me? And for most of us who live in the burbs or a city, it's already been laid out on a grid, has nothing to do with the topography, has nothing to do with the geology, has nothing to do with the way the water flows, how the sun hits. So first you just got to pay attention. Well, what is nature giving me? How is the sunlight hitting this? How is the sunlight hit it in the spring, summer, fall? How does the water flow? Does the water flow? All those kind of things. So you have to just take some time and pay attention to your land. Look at your land, look at the slope, look at the grade, all those kind of things. And then the next step is how can we catch and store as much energy as possible? And so in our like suburban lots, you're basically talking about water is the big thing and solar energy. Those are the two things you're trying to catch and store. Unless you want to get really ambitious and maybe put in some turbines, you know, wind turbines mm-hmm. and things. But, you know, basically, how can I use the way the sun is hitting my land? How can I use that to the best effect? And how can I use the water that's falling on my land? Now, living in Wheaton, you know, being built on a swamp, basically, you know, we have the problem of too much water. And it's kind of sad. I had to basically use all the things I learned about permaculture and do the opposite, get the water off the land because of flooding. But
I have that problem in Downers Grove.
Right. Yeah. DuPage County, we try to make nature do what we want. And, you know, the last few decades, nature's kind of getting a good chuckle. You know, oh, you want to build that dike, you want to build that levee, you want to, you know, and she knocks it over. So we've got to catch and store the energy. So there are things, permaculture, big swales. So pay attention to the slope. You dig a big ditch on contour. So imagine the water flowing across your front yard, whichever way it's angled. And imagine putting ditches in that would catch the water as it's flowing down. Okay, and then you fill that with organic. And then on either side, you plant trees and bushes and veg and different things that you want. And so you're...
Wait, on either side of...
Of that swale, that ditch that you filled in with compost or whatever. And Jeff Loughton, who's one of the big permaculture gurus today, and you can look him up online. He has online classes you can take and things like that. He was given 10 acres in Jordan, dead, salted, dead, because it had been overgrazed, overfarmed, the sand was salty. You just, you know, you couldn't do anything with it unless you fertilized the heck out of it. So he was given that land, found a bit of pitch, put in the swales, took all the organic that the local farmers would burn. Right?
Oh, yeah.
And he'd fill his swales. So he had these meter deep, meter wide swales. And he started planting trees, and all the locals are laughing at him because he's not producing stuff that's going to produce food, or at least not right away. And he's like, no, I need to fix the nitrogen in the soil. And then he planted figs on the other side. Well, they were getting baby figs on these baby trees, you know, in a matter of months. And they kind of freaked out because they said, we've got fungus. Well, in recent memory, nobody had dealt with mushrooms or things like that in that climate because of the way we've kind of destroyed the Middle East through the farming practices. And that's what was going on. And it turned out that the mushrooms and all their fungi were actually fixing the soil. They're isolating the salts and doing all sorts of cool things. And he basically produced a place that was producing nuts and figs and all this food on 11 inches of water a year.
Oh.
So
pretty amazing, huh?
That's catching and storing energy.
Wow. And those are the things that should be growing there.
Right. And so, and that goes into principle, or principle three, obtain a yield. If you're going to do this work, make it do something for you. Grow some food or grow something that is beautiful or grow something you can sell. But, you know, permaculture isn't about, oh, we're just trying to save the planet here. We also want to get a product out of this and, you know, have it be a benefit. And then looking at your system as you're growing, you know, go in baby steps, take a look. Look for ways for the system to self-regulate itself, all right? Mm. The ideal is once you get your setup, whatever you want to grow, that you're basically coming in doing a slash and drop in the fall, you know, just cutting down stuff that you want cut down, letting it drop and compost, and then harvesting, you know? And after that, you know, none of this annual stuff, you know, you want perennials. You want things that are going to keep producing over time. You want to use and value renewable resources and services whenever you can, so using animals. And, of course, this all is going to work way better on a smaller scale. You cannot do the huge factory farm permaculture style. Okay, so if you're going to start in, you know, the farms that are growing, you're much more human intensive, you know, so it's going to be more expensive food. But you're also putting more people to work. You're helping out the economy. You're giving people jobs, so that's good as well. And using renewable resources where you can. On a smaller scale, things like wind and solar and things like that might work a lot better than they're finding these huge scale alternative energy projects are turning out to be. And then point six, no waste. Waste equals food. That comes from cradle-to-cradle thinking as well. And so everything has to be able to be used for something else. So the plants, when you chop and drop them, that's the compost for new soil. That can become the mulch. That can become, you know, things like that. And then design from patterns. You tend not to use rows. You look at the way nature does things. You look at a spider web and the shapes. And so you plant gardens with basically... keyholes, they look like flower patterns and things like that, so you can always get to your plants. You're within hand's reach. And so you're not stepping on the soil where you're trying to grow stuff, because when you're stepping on the soil or you're running machinery over the soil where you're trying to grow stuff, you're compacting it. You're making it harder for the plants to do their thing. And I
saw pictures like that when I was looking up permaculture, and it's strange looking.
Very. Yeah, it looks very hippy-dippy.
It doesn't look like a place we grow food.
The first time my wife and I put in a garden at our old church in Lombard, and it had this very unusual, you know, pattern and shape to it, and everyone's looking at it like, what the heck? But when people saw the amount of food that was growing in this mix of, you know, we had beans growing up the corn, and we had, you know, all this stuff, you know, together, because some plants are attracting some kind of insects. Other plants attract others. And a lot of the guys we might call a pest. Well, if you've got other plants in there, they're attracting guys that are going to eat those guys. And you've got plants that are putting nutrients in the soil. You've got other plants that are using those nutrients.
Oh, that's what you were kind of talking about when you talked about companion plants.
Companion gardening, yep.
Yeah. Like the classic three sister.
Well, I was just going to say the three sisters, that's just so perfect because your beans climbing the corn. That
beans,
is perfect.
Corn,
and squash.
Mm-hmm.
Because the big, huge leaves keep the weeds down, keep the moisture down there. Those big leaves keep it wet and keep it moist so that the plants can grow. And the timing is perfect. The beans are ready first, corn is ready second, squash is ready third. Mm-hmm. They say, the three sisters, you cannot get today out of an acre of land, you can't get the same nutrients as you could get out of an acre of three sisters.
Mm. Right.
But it all has to be hand harvested.
Right.
And that takes more time, but lots more nutrition.
Right.
And the one plant is taking nitrogen, the other one's putting it back. It's all working together the way nature needs it to work.
That makes so much sense.
Right. And the more you can integrate versus segregate. Monoculture farming, while, yeah, it created civilization 10,000 years ago, it's also created the Middle East being a desert now. So, you know, it's not how nature works. When you wipe everything out and just try to grow one thing, all those quote-unquote weeds are nature's way of saying, hey, we're trying to fix this for you here, you know, but we keep wiping it out.
More and more studies are showing, too, that if you plant milkweed with your corn, if you plant some of these native plants that some people call weeds, and now we know milkweed is not a weed, but when you plant these plants with the food you want to grow, you get more yield, so you're getting more for what you're doing. And the insects that we call pests that are not pests in nature, they love the milkweed. So Cornell has done big, huge studies on this. There's a big project that just came out of California. So knowing to mix these things together instead of just one crop.
Yep. So another idea is to use small and slow solutions. A lot of times when we learn about something, we just want to dive in. And that can get really expensive and not work at all. Because, again, you're taking that classic, you know, human approach. I'm going to make nature do what I want.
That is how we've been when you really think about it. This is really a big change in thinking.
Yes. Yeah, it's a totally different design. And to go slow. And it's okay to make mistakes. That's actually point 12, creatively use and respond to change. So you try something, you see what happens, you adapt, you respond. So point 10, use and value diversity. The more diverse a system is, the stronger it is.
The healthier it is,
right.
Too.
Biology loves diversity. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, you can have, like an ideal permaculture farm would actually end up looking more like a forest, and it would have 7 different layers. And so you have trees, you have nuts, you have berries, you have bushes, you have veg, you have flowers, you have herbs, you have, you know, and it's all together. It's all growing together and mixing together. Now, that doesn't mean you can't have your raised beds and, you know, you're just doing some intensive veg or herb growing and
something
things like
that.
Something
you really want to have more of.
Right. But even there, you pack it in. You pack it in. I don't like weeding. Do you like weeding?
No.
I don't like weeding. Right. So you pack it in, right? And you mulch over it, and you do things, you know, to hold the water, capture that resource, and to make your life less busy. You know, let nature do the work. We're here to tend the garden, okay? We're not here to force the garden. And using edges, value the marginal. The more edges you have, the more creative you can be. And even in a suburban setting, most people don't realize how many different microclimates they have in their yard. I mean, really different climates, to the point where you can sometimes even get away with growing stuff that really isn't in your zone. But because you've got a south wall and it's a white wall and things like that, all of a sudden you can grow something that comes from a hotter place, or you've got someplace else where you can get away growing a plant that likes it cooler because you're using a different part. And so if you look on permaculture sites, like they'll have little herb gardens that are built in a 3D spiral and literally using different herbs on different sides of the spiral, north, south, east, or west, because they like this versus that, and paying attention to
and
those
you,
little
and
things.
And you only know that because of what your experience
right,
is, right?
Paying attention and learning from other people. So I first became interested in this because we've done units for years on human impact and how do we, you know, how do we help?
In you know, your eighth grade class?
Right, eighth grade, right. And so we would look at housing, we'd look at energy, we'd look at food. Because food production and energy, those are the big guys, you know, as far as, you know, creating a lot of the problems. And so I stumbled across this, and I took a class through University of Oregon online. It was really hard, you know, working and doing that class, because they wanted a lot of stuff done. But, you know, they would have you do your own lot. And so, I'm looking at my lot, and it's like, oh, wow, okay, that explains flooding. When you look at the footprint, you know, the house, the garage, and the driveway, you know, that's like 60-70% of your lot.
Yeah.
Right, there's no place for the water to go. So I literally put in swales that go along the south and north edge of my yard.
Okay, yeah.
And trying to get it slope and trying to get some to slope in DuPage can be tough when you're in the flat part. And to get it to slope from the back towards the street, and then literally re-guttered the house and the garage so everything goes into the swales. And so even the last, 2013, those swales fill with water and it floods the sidewalks in front of the neighbors' yards. I'm draining their yards too. They don't complain.
Yeah.
But we haven't had issues.
So does through the swale then, does the water go to the storm source?
Yes. And so I'm using it the opposite of way a permaculturist would use it. A permaculturist would put the swale in the other way and try to capture the water.
Yeah.
But when you're built basically on a floodplain over an old swamp, again, adapt. The thing here is not trying to catch the water. That's not as big of a problem for us. The thing here is trying to keep your house dry. You've got to be practical about it, too.
Well, that was really smart.
Yeah. So permaculturalists try to be very practical. So, like, things like a chicken tractor, if you're going to do chickens in the city or the burbs, you have a little portable coop, and you move that coop around your garden, your yard, and you let the chickens do picking, the bugs and picking at the weeds and fertilizing for you and scratching up the soil and doing all that work. I don't want to do it. Let them do it, right? And then some people have gotten really creative where they build the night coop onto the back of the greenhouse they have, and then where the chickens roost, that drops down into the pond they have next to that. So the droppings fertilize the pond. I mean, they just try to think, how can we turn everything into a resource for something else?
Yeah. That is so interesting.
Amazing.
It is. So have you done some of this at school?
School, no, because it's really hard to get schools to do anything. I mean, they've been trained in composting and they do none of it.
Some do.
Yeah.
Well, my school.
Ours did for a while. I hope they still are.
Yeah. So, but what I did is like church gardens and community gardens and things like that.
Uh-huh.
And then, at my own house, I'll just, we'll throw stuff together. This year, we're basically mostly doing herbs, to be honest.
Uh-huh.
So our schedules are really crazy and we're just like, well, herbs are easy.
So that's what's in your garden right now. What other things have you grown?
Oh, veg, different veg. So for instance, we've done things where like broccoli. And we tend to plant in compost.
In the compost.
Yeah. We don't really bother with the soil a whole lot.
Yeah.
We've had 5 foot tall broccoli.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. I mean, it's kind of crazy.
You did teach your eighth graders about
this. Oh yeah. Yeah.
So did they seem enthused?
Yeah. Yeah. They thought it was pretty cool. And when you can show them examples, like you show them pictures of Jeff Loughton's farm out in Australia where people can go and intern, to learn how to do it and things. And so here he's got this farm, and even during a drought, his farm is green. And around him, you see the brownouts.
I think I've seen a picture of that.
And then Miraculous Abundance farm in France, that's a famous one. And what's really cool is when you look that up, it's just this little 5-acre farm, and it's got the classic French farms all around it, rangeland and monoculture. And then you've got this crazy explosion of 5 acres of all this life and vibrancy. And, they just muddled their way through it. They kind of stumbled and try this, try that. But now their stuff, chefs from Paris and big fancy restaurants come out just to buy their stuff because it does taste different.
It tastes better.
Is different.
Yeah. Oh, I wanted to ask you, when you said you planted, that you and your wife planted mm-hmm. in compost.
Yeah.
You don't mean you planted in the compost bin.
You took
the compost and put it in all the places where you were going to, and just...
Or when we built raised beds, we would just get compost and throw it in there. And just plant in that.
Sure.
Yeah.
Sure. I know a friend of mine, he had his compost behind his garage, and he didn't ever really want to look at it. And I said, well, what are you doing with your compost? He goes, I don't know. And I said, why don't you put it where you're growing your tomatoes? He goes, really? I said, yes, Al, just put it where you're growing your tomatoes. That year, 5 foot tall tomato plants.
Oh, my gosh.
That is exactly the height. And everybody wanted Al's tomatoes. There was so much more flavor.
Yeah.
He did no work for them. He says, I put them in the ground can. I put the compost in under when I planted, and I put it around it. And I said, yeah.
Well, you're not watering hardly at all. When I did the community garden, Planter's Pallet was nice enough to let me use some land because a buddy of mine happened to be working for them at the time. And they're like, perma what? You know. So I think they just thought it might be kind of fun to watch what that guy was doing. But, you know, it'd be interesting. I'd go out there and check on things. And I didn't water a lot. You know, I was helping Kay teach classes, you know, doing other things. And I just don't have time for this. So watered a bit when I started it, then covered everything in straw and mulch. And, you know, they would be watering, you know, under their plastic to get their veggies going and everything. And I didn't, and, you know, big yields and
delicious.
Yeah. And the church garden, we didn't really water it hardly ever. And the food pantry just like, where the heck did you get all this? And we're not talking big gardens. We're talking like 25 feet in diameter.
Yeah.
And I mean, just bushels of food.
Yeah. That's amazing.
Yeah.
And delicious food.
Yeah.
Not just.
Yeah. I mean, again, work with nature instead of trying to fight her.
She does things. Common sense idea, and yet it feels like so different.
Yeah, common sense ain't so common.
And it's not so sensical. Right.
Yeah. I had one other question. Oh, have you heard about the Climate Victory Gardens?
No.
Okay, well, that's a movement that Green America is promoting. And they're kind of riffing on the idea of victory gardens from World War II to World War I, actually, too.
Yes,
they
yes,
did that,
mm-hmm.
and they were very successful. People grew their own produce. I mean, most of the people, my brother tells me, because he's older than I, but he tells me he remembers our dad, who was not a gardener, gardening in our backyard. So everybody did it, mm-hmm. pretty much. And so now with climate change, they're kind of using the idea of victory gardens, and they're calling them climate victory gardens. Mm. And Green America actually has a map of, you know, everybody who does this. And it sounds like the same idea. They're using these principles. They've got it down to, I don't think they have 12, but they're pretty much the same. You know, the chop and drop. Mm-hmm. They want you to keep your ground covered. They you don't have to weed a lot, you know. Let's see, what else? Well, almost everything you said is what they're promoting. And the reason they are is that it produces healthy soil.
Mm-hmm.
And the healthy soil with all the microbes, which we also talked about in gardens, takes in more carbon dioxide. Huge amounts of carbon dioxide. So that's part of the climate solution. Yeah.
Sure. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and if you can turn a desert in a couple of years into a garden, you know, we could literally think of the Middle East, Africa, all these places.
Yeah.
And if you go on YouTube and just permaculture, like Arizona, things like that, there's a lot of cool things people are doing, because a lot of those areas in the Southwest used to actually be wetter. The rivers ran all year, or at least longer. You know, now you have all these dried up creek beds and rivers, and it's because we've tapped the aquifers. We've drained it from underneath. You know, the way we ranch and the way we farm, that tends to lead to desertification as well. So, like some of these guys, this isn't exactly legal, but they would go out at night and cut curbs. Did get a rain, like in Arizona, it's more flash, right?
Yeah.
So how do you catch that? So they would cut the curb so the water could come into that, you know, piece of land between the street and the sidewalk. And then they would put in some little swales, and then they would plant, you know, nut trees and other things. And all that water would rush in, get slowed down, get caught, form a little plume of water underneath. And all of a sudden, you're growing all this food in the median strips in the desert.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And so you cut one end of the curb, you cut the other end of the curb. The overflow can flow back out into the street. Of course, you know, you start thinking of this from the standpoint of neighborhoods. You know, so for instance, what if you grow a fruit tree and a nut tree and some veg and things like that, but your neighbor's yard would be more suited to something else, And all of a sudden, people might actually start talking to each other, maybe sharing food, you know.
What a concept.
Yeah, and you could literally start transforming communities through food.
What a great idea. Are your neighbors interested in what you're doing?
Not so much.
Oh.
I know our biggest garden when our kids were really little was like 20 by 15-ish.
That's great.
And
good size.
Well, I was home with two little kids. I had lots of time. We grew so much food.
Oh.
And then we were like, uh-oh.
Yeah.
You don't want to waste the food that you hand-reared and right? And watered and tended. So, and there's only so much you can freeze of zucchini and stuff. So pretty soon we were delivering it, the kids in the wagon, and I would go to the, we had senior citizens that lived around us, and we'd put some food in the wagon, and we'd pull the wagon over to the neighbors, and do you guys need any tomatoes? And they look. And the kids got really good, and the kids actually got more attention than I did in delivering the food.
Well, no fair.
Well, you know, they helped. But, you know, kind of hard to turn down a kid holding a little tiny bag of cherry tomatoes, right? And the currants. We had a currant bush. Who even had a currant bush? But we had one. The house was in a very old neighborhood, so the currant bush was there. And, wow, we learned quickly, you know, currant jelly and things like that. But you still had a lot of currants, and you didn't want it to go to waste. So we got really good at donating food to neighbors. And as Mike's point is, we got to know our neighbors.
Right.
And the kids had so many grandmas and grandpas all over Illinois Street in Wheaton. It was quite fun. And our daughter went to a preschool that had to do with a high school.
Uh-huh.
So she wanted to bring, in the fall, when that was starting, she wanted to bring food to the preschool at the high school, Glenbard East High School. And so I said, sure. So she picked and everything and made her little bags and brought it. It's a really wonderful way to meet people,
mm-hmm.
to share what you grew, and bring us all to some connection. It was a very nice connection.
Yeah.
We brought it to our church, Trinity Episcopal in Wheaton, and had their little bags. They were both in the choir, and they'd bring their little bags of food, you know, and worked perfectly.
Cute.
But it is. It's a good way. My grandpa, during World War II, he grew a lot of food. He was a very good farmer from Poland, and he grew a lot of food. He'd been injured in a train accident, and so he was home. And so he grew food, and he fed the neighborhood during World War II. He fed the neighborhood with vegetables. He really knew how to farm, and he liked it. And even with his bad back, he really fed the neighborhood, because a lot of men were gone to the war,
uh-huh.
and families were really struggling to have food. So he grew the food, and he fed the neighborhood.
Good history.
Yep.
And you know what occurs to me, listening to this, and Mike talking about the Middle East, or, you know, and, mm-hmm. and how desolate mm-hmm. the land is. It seems like it took centuries for it to become that bad. And yet, look how fast, if you work with nature, look how fast
it
recuperates.
Yeah, nature on its own doesn't make soil super quick. But when we humans cooperate, I mean, you can make soil in months under the right conditions, right? So, and that's another thing I find kind of hopeful about permaculture, is it's definitely a different mindset. If you think about the mindset in the world today, and it's been this way for a while, it's one of scarcity.
There isn't enough.
There's plenty. There's an abundance of energy, and there's an abundance of everything we need. And even with our population size, everything else, there is an abundance if you work with it.
You got to work with it.
Right.
Yeah.
Well,
and
we waste so much food. There,
mm-hmm.
there's so much food waste. I don't know about every country, but in our country.
Sure.
There's a tremendous, and you think about all the water and the energy and the work.
And imagine if we composted all that.
Mm-hmm.
That's our goal, right?
Yeah.
Get more and more food scrap composting. Feed people.
Yep.
And then feed the soil with compost so that we don't waste any of the water or any of the nutrients or the microbes.
Well, it sounds like permaculture has really good benefits to us, not only for our health and for our environment, but for our social life.
And it gets you thinking about everything. A lot of times people get involved in permaculture, and all of a sudden they're interested in earthships, and, you know, they're interested in how we house ourselves, how we, you know, everything.
Oh, yeah.
And
yeah.
So it definitely... And, you know, here in Illinois, Midwest permaculture, is a really good outfit. I took a class with them. It was actually down in Ohio. It was a whole week on permaculture farming.
Oh.
And so how this farmer literally transformed his farm into a more permaculture system. And he had a flurd. So a flock and a herd.
Oh.
So he had cows and sheep together. And he basically, all around him, he had farmers raising cattle or sheep or both. And they're paying all this money to feed them, you know, and then you try to get them up to weight and you sell them, right? So he let his farm just go native. Whatever grew, and that's what they ate.
Oh.
So now he's not spending all that money on feed, right? And the animals didn't stay in barns. It was funny, one of the people in the class asked, well, where do the animals go at night? He's like, you know, before us humans showed up, they didn't have any buildings.
There were no barns.
All right. No. Now, it is good to have some trees and stands and, you know, different elevations. You know, the animals know what to do and where to go. And but, yeah, it was amazing. And he literally would move the flirt around the farm every so many days. He had an electric fence that he could just roll up real quick. And he would move them around, so by the time they got back to that part of the farm, it had been over 90 days. So any of the parasites had died out. So he didn't. He said, "Yeah, I hardly ever see the vet. You know, so I'm not spending money on that. I'm not spending money on feed. I'm getting to sell my food as, you know, grass-fed and you know, all this other. And you know, the sad thing is, even with all that, he's barely making margins.
Sure.
Because we Americans don't like to pay for our food.
Right. Yeah. That's something I think about a lot.
Do you guys know Thomas Jefferson learned that when he was visiting in Italy to move your herds around?
Mm-hmm.
He learned that they had little bridges, and they would lift up the bridges, and the sheep or the cattle would go where they were supposed to go, and they would close them, and then he'd move them to another field. And he brought that idea back from Italy way back when. One, they had fresh food, which was really nice. And two, they didn't get into where his food was that he was growing for everybody who lived at Monticello. So he kind of kept them where he wanted, but he moved them around. And he learned that in Italy, and he was just amazed about the idea. It's not that you needed more and more land. You just needed to move them around so food would grow again, and they wouldn't be in the food you were trying to grow. Mm-hmm. So pretty easy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm getting so enthused about this. So
there's a ton of stuff on the internet.
So you say Midwest.
Midwest permaculture, Steele, Illinois.
That's something I could.
It's real interesting, too, because he has a picture of his house. It's just a suburban house in the middle of a suburban, you know, development. And it's all these trees and bushes and fruit and nuts and veg and all these other things. So, Jeff Loughton, a lot of online classes you can take. There's a lot of cool stuff going on. A lot of training in places where poverty is a problem. We've brought up the Middle East a lot. You know, a lot of the immigration issues is because they can't farm. So they go to the cities, there aren't any jobs. So they try to go to a country where they can find a job, you know. So if we could give them ways to go back and be able to farm their land again.
Oh, yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Right.
Well, you know what? This is probably where we should
end
our conversation. But, you know, we always try to end with a daily doable, Mike. So something that everybody can do, even if you're not going to go all the way with your permaculture gardening right away.
Mm-hmm.
But what's one thing we could do that would point us in that direction?
I would suggest, and this is what I usually tell my students, look into plant guilds. So people have already done all the work. What plants like what plants? What plants work well together? And start with a plant guild in your garden or in your yard. You know, do you want it to be a tree? Do you want it to be a bush? You know, you pick the scale. But figure out a guild that would work well in the land you've got, or the piece of the yard you want to work with.
Uh-huh.
And just start there.
Oh, that's a really good idea. A plant guild. That's G-U-I-L-D,
right? You got it.
So if somebody wants to look that up,
yep.
Google it.
Yep.
And it's not too late to start. We just had the summer solstice, right?
Yeah.
We're ready to go.
Permaculture plant guilds, you'll get all sorts of hits. In fact, Midwest Permaculture on their site, they have a whole free e-booklet filled with guilds for the Midwest.
Oh, that's a great resource.
Yeah.
All right. Well, thank you.
And how fun, you. Right?
Yes. We're
Learn
ready to
something
go.
New. Ready.
Get me my pitchfork. That's it for now, everybody.
All right, everybody. Thanks for listening to this episode of Earth Chats. Do you have any questions, comments, ideas? You can always email us at earthchats@scarce.org. And as always, if you like what you hear, don't forget to hit that subscribe button on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Play, or however you are tuning in. You guys can find us on social media, on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook at EarthChatsPod. And you can use the hashtag EarthChats to send us photos of you getting out there and doing daily doables. And maybe we'll even share them on our page. Thanks for joining us. This podcast would not be possible without the creativity and driving force of Louise Kelly, our creative director, Bella Kelly, our sound engineer, Carrie Horak, our tech wizard, and Carol Richard, our interview director, as well as the generous backing of Scarce, an award-winning environmental nonprofit who's on a mission to inspire environmental action through education, protecting people and the planet one day at a time.